Oh, well, we'll get started.
Monday, February 19th. We're starting a few minutes late here, but we're going to, well, we did adjourn the meeting.
It's your first evening here.
We spent exactly 2 hours on Thursday. The proponents had an hour and 45 minutes. We had two opponents, I believe, that spoke for, we used up about 15 minutes. I think, and there were a lot of questions. I don't know that we'll have that many questions as we go forward with this testimony now. But Senator Betzel, did you have anything to say before we begin, or?
Nothing further.
Okay. Then, members, I'm going to go to the agenda for the evening. And ask Mr. Gross from the Department of Commerce to speak. And members might add Ray Schwab, because she was on the list the other day. By mistake, wasn't on here. And then Lou Gruber from Amtrak. Gross, good evening. Welcome.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Betzel. My name is John Gross. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Just a little historical data. A couple of years ago, there was a study created by the Department of Sewer and Commerce performing a study to look at this concept of creating a group. There was a report that had pluses and minuses to it. We're addressing this again tonight. So the Commerce Department, as you may know, is a regulator of many healthcare entities, regulating all insurance companies, the health department regulates the HMOs, but the Commerce Department does provide all the financial assistance to the Minnesota Department of Health, between health and commerce. Any entity that wants to sell healthcare coverage in Minnesota has to get regulated by one of us. Another misconception might be out there.
We're going to get you a line yet here.
Another issue that some people might have is this concept of self-insurance. If you're a single employer, 3M, a single self-insured union, you're self-insured, you are exempt from state regulation under the federal ERISA law. However, there's an exception to the federal ERISA law that says if it's a government plan, state, county, city, school district, whatever, they are subject to state regulations. So if somebody wants to, like in this proposal here, creating a self-insured pool, that's self-insured because it's the school teachers, government type of entity, it will be subject to state regulations. So there's no way that any type of entity, like a government plan, will be exempt from state regulations. The theme I like to bestow upon everybody tonight is simply this. We've got a number of questions, but it all pivots around accountability. For example, we're talking about providing a pool that will insure 200,000 more people. And our greatest concern is, again, who's going to assume this healthcare risk? If you start off fully insured, then the insurance companies have that assumption or if they want to convert over to a self-funded plan, once those insurance policies end, there is no obligation on that insurance company or HMO for this group. It would be the self-funded group that has to fully assume the risk. And so our biggest question is, how is this going to be funded? How are the reserves going to be built up to be adequately funding the risk that this entity will assume? One could argue that you could build it up over time. You can increase the premiums to compensate for that, but then you're going to raise your premiums above that, I guess you could say, average market rate to build up those reserves. The question we've always had is on day one, if you have a tragic school bus accident, or if you come up with some new miracle drug that's going to cost $28,000 per person, how is this all going to be paid for?
We do have in Minnesota regulations for multi-employer welfare arrangements. These are a number of employers grouping together to insure themselves, and also for political subdivisions. And in both of those pieces of legislation we have in Minnesota, We do allow that entity, if they run out of money or have financial problems, to assess their members, meaning you pay a premium, but you can also, the entity can come back and assess the members for additional dollars. So that's one way of maybe resolving some issues that down the road if the entity has some financial problems. This group is going to provide to the legislators on January 15, 2009, their plan. The question we might have is, all right, should the legislators have another shot at that plan and say, all right, let's look at this thing from cover to cover and see if it's feasible, see if it's going to meet all the requirements the legislators can think of. Once this thing is enacted, July 1st, 2009, starts up, they don't start reporting to the Department of Commerce until 2011 with reports. To us, this is a big problem. Any health insurance company that Health or Commerce regulates have to send to us an annual statement. This is the HMOs are send their annual statement on April 1st. The insurance companies send their annual statement on March 1st for the preceding year. So obviously for the year 2006, the insurance companies will be sending that to us March 1st. The HMOs and the Blues will be sending that to us on April 1st. What also has to come in quarterly is other financial statements. What this department and all the other states, all 50 states, are diligently looking at the entity that they regulate to make sure they don't have financial problems, especially a healthcare company. That's a huge, huge risk because you don't know tomorrow what's going to happen. You can also look at that, too. For example, a property casualty company where you get a large number of hurricanes or tornadoes or whatever. You have to be properly reserved to, you know, bite the bullet or whatever in a sense of being able to take care of those losses. I doubt very much we would want some entity out there that provides health insurance and then starts writing out IOUs to the doctors in the hospitals. I don't think that would be acceptable. So the one of the concerns we do have, again, is if this thing is going to get started on July 1st, 2009, then we would like to see some reporting as to their financial stability, obviously in the beginning and then quarterly. We do have occasionally with Commerce, an insurance company that might be, we look at it on a quarterly basis, having some financial problems. Then we put them on a monthly report. And so we're looking at them very, very closely to make sure they can assume this health care risk.
Mr. Gross, may I interrupt just a moment to ask if, you know, under ERISA, they don't, generally they're not within the purview of the department, but because it's governmental, is that why you would be able to do, to require those, right? Do we have anything else that's the same kind of animal? Do we have any other kind of group?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, under Minnesota Statute 471.617, any political subdivision, meaning two or more political subdivisions want to get together and create some kind of a self-insured pool, then that's where we would regulate that type of organization. And then there's also the one about multi-employer welfare arrangement. That's where private employers want to get together and do the same thing. Again, we can regulate those things. And the main, again, theme here is to make sure that the entity can pay its bills. You just don't know tomorrow what's going to happen.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gross, maybe you are addressing this. I'm just not hearing it very clearly, I guess. But in the past, when I've tried to pass legislation regarding the MIWAs, I don't even know if we've got any of those operating now, or there's a employer-based provider coverage up in the Duluth area that I've tried to pass, there's always been a requirement that there be a reserve fund of some sort. And I'm just wondering if there is a requirement for a bill like this or a fund like this, a large pool like this, to have a reserve fund. And if so, is there a recommended amount that needs to be there before it can start to operate? Or
Madam Chairman, Senator Solon, there's nothing in the bill about that level or that requirement. That's something that we strongly think should be put in the bill, that some kind of a precise surplus or reserve surplus requirement. The other part that goes with this type of entity, and I would assume I know it's written in the proposed legislation, this pool would also want to purchase what is called stop-loss insurance. And that's more or less protecting themselves from catastrophic claims. So they would have a combination of reserves, surplus, and then stop-loss coverage. And in a sense, the more they have, the more happy we are, because then we know that they're going to be well-funded to take care of any future claims.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, it seems to me, though, that though I've passed MEWA legislation in the past, that it was always the department that stopped us from being able to move forward with it, because there wasn't a pool. That was my understanding. And is it possible for a fund to start with the first day of premiums and to provide the type of coverage that's necessary, or does there need to be a pool of money there first before this plan would be able to operate? Mr. Gross.
Madam Chairman, Senator Solon, we would look at it very conservatively and require that the entity to, if they want to assume health care risks, on day one to have a certain amount of reserves readily available.
Senator Prettner-Solon, I think, I don't know if you're still thinking about the MEWAs, but hasn't one of the problems with the MEWAs been that they haven't been able to establish a necessary reserve? Mr. Gross, and maybe you can...
Madam Chairman, Senator Solon, we currently right now have two MEWAs that are very much interested in becoming licensed and regulated by Commerce. We've had numerous meetings with them, and we've gone through all the rules, all the statutes, and I think they understand the main thing that they have to obtain is to have readily available day one surplus reserves. And so we might actually have one or two MEWAs licensed maybe this year, because they do have met that requirement. If you wish, I could have our actuary, Julia Phillips, come up here and get more details on the surplus and reserves aspect.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gross, maybe I can ask it more specifically. Even if we were past this legislation, is the department going to weigh in and say, well, it can't go forward because it doesn't have the necessary reserves?
Madam Chairman, Senator Solon, the way this proposed bill is written, we don't have any authority at all with this organization.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gross, I'm not familiar with the structure of the MEWAs, so I just have to ask you for a little background. Were they intending to become self-insured from day one, or were they purchasing policies to insure the risk as this program is designed to do?
Madam Chairman, Senator, they're designed from day one to be self-funded.
Well, then,
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gross, isn't there a big difference? I mean, in this situation, the whole purpose of the reserves is to cover your risk when you're self-insured. If you're not self-insured, why would it be necessary to have the large reserves from day one?
Mr. Gross.
Madam Chairman, Senator, if the school pool wants to be self-insured, then that's, I'm just raising that question. We believe that if they decide to be in the beginning fully insured, meaning going out and purchasing insurance, that we don't have a problem with that. But when they switch over to being self-funded, we would hope that they have an adequate amount of reserves. One of the comments that was made last Thursday, which I want to correct, is this assumption or this comment that when you purchase insurance and the policy, let's say this group purchases insurance to begin with in July of 2009 and they decide on January 1st, 2011 to become self-funded, when that insurance policy ends on December 31st, 2010, that's when coverage ends. There's no carryover. So when the entity wants to become self-insured the following day, they should have adequate amount of reserves.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Okay. And I wasn't confused on that point. I'm not sure if someone else did misstate that. But I know that's the way health insurance works, that it isn't, you know, a carryback mm-hmm. type of insurance. But why is the department specifically concerned with this pool? In terms of, you said, you know, you're worried that if something comes up like a new drug or a catastrophic accident. Isn't that true of any group? And isn't the larger the pool, the less reason there is to be concerned about that kind of spreading of the risk?
Mr. Madam Chairman, Senator, I think what we're concerned about is the statute specifically says the state is not liable for this entity. So who is?
But is
Madam Chair,
but isn't that true of any self-insured group or any group that we have, and we have many of them in the state who have been operating quite well? I mean, what is there something unique that would make this more of a risk for this pool?
Madam Chairman, Senator, let's take an employer of 500 or 1,000 employees that wants to become self-insured. They're going to assume that health care risk themselves, and they have to be, again, in our minds, well-funded, adequately protected with stop loss. They have assets they could dip into to use to pay their claims that they might, you know, misjudge as to what the claim amounts were. They have actually some kind of something in the back there they could use to pay for their claims. The question, again, we're sort of raising a lot of questions here, is what's this pool going to use in case they run out of reserves if they misjudge that?
Does that follow, Senator Olson? You understand?
Yeah. I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Prentner-Solon, did you have any further questions? Okay. Mr. Gross.
The only other question we have is, and I understand, I think I understand what they're accomplishing, and if somebody doesn't understand, I'm more than happy, or maybe Christine could help. What the group is looking at is taking all these school districts and putting them into a big pool. Now, some of those school districts are funded by self-insured, the cooperatives, and some actually have purchased insurance. And it's looking at the bill here, I'm making the assumption about a third of them actually have insurance. That's why under this proposed legislation, they have to pay a third of the – typically, a healthcare entity in Minnesota has to help fund our risk pool, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, based on written premiums. And they also have to pay a 1% or 2% premium tax to the state treasurer. Under this proposed legislation, they're going to be paying basically one-third of that. And I think it's basically based on the concept that the current market, maybe two-thirds of it right now, is sort of the self-funded type one where you don't have to do this, and then the other third is the fully insured market. But, again, that's just a question. Is this the way we want to do it? Because you think about in the future, if this entity by chance has – for some unlucky person, has to go through their lifetime maximum, whatever that may be, in this particular pool, our risk pool, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, then has to take over and pay the rest of the claims until that person, is well. So, but they're not going to be properly funding our risk pool. So that's just another issue or concern we have about the way the legislation is being proposed. Should this pool only pay a third of what the current health carers have to pay, or should it be the full amount?
Mr. Gross, what would you say the reserve should be for an entity with 200,000 persons? Is there a rule of thumb?
Madam Chairman, I'm going to ask Julia Phillips, our health actuary, to help out on that.
Ms. Phillips, welcome. Thank you for coming this evening.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, Senators. The rule of thumb that we would normally use is something that we have in statute right now for the health insurance companies. It is called risk-based capital. And we put it in to replace the corridors, which you may remember the corridors. It's similar to the corridors, but it is more closely based on the riskiness of the business. It's a very complicated formula. Essentially, the risk-based capital formula would give you something in the neighborhood of $150 million that you would need for this type of entity. And I haven't actually run the number, but it's, you know, in the ballpark of that type of number. And the reason that you need that is that as this entity goes into business, they are going to be estimating the medical costs for this group of 200,000 people. And I think Senator Olson was quite right to say the larger the group, the more predictable it is. So we are not concerned, you know, with the MIWAs, we were concerned about the possibility there would be a catastrophic claim, $1 million claim, a $5 million claim, and they wouldn't have money if it was a small MIWA. This is a different concern. This concern, I think, is that those rates are set, and then they really can't be changed for a year. You know, they predict the medical costs. They say, okay, per subscriber, it's going to be $300 per month per person, and everything starts rolling forward. What if medical care cost, you think it was going to go up 10%, and it goes up 20%? Suddenly, you have a 10% shortfall, and you can't turn on a dime. You know, a self-insured employer can say, okay, I better dip into my cash. This is an organization that has a set contribution level. The school districts are looking at their population, paying a set amount of money. And I suppose what they would have to do is they would have to go back to the school districts and ask for more money. I'm not sure that that's in the structure that's been set up. And that's where there's no organization that I know of in the world that provides this large amount of health care coverage that doesn't have a fund similar to the risk-based capital or that level of fund. And if you want to put it another way, you could say that you need roughly 10 or 15% of an annual cost for medical care and administrative expenses in the bank in order to be running in a safe and sound manner. And that's very rough. You know, actuaries like to sit down and calculate everything to the 10th decimal place, but I didn't think you would appreciate it. So I'm trying to be off the cuff here.
We appreciate that you didn't. No,
that's good. Thank you, Ms. Phillips. So that 10 to 15% is of the portion of the risk that's out there. Is that what you're...
That's if you look at a year, because mm-hmm. people generally measure it in terms of a year. If you look at a year and you look at what you expect to pay out in a year for the medical costs directly and for the administrative expenses, and medical costs per person, you might, let's say that you're talking about $2,500 per person per year, okay? You have 200,000 people. Okay, so somebody with a calculator maybe can tell me what the annual estimated payout is going to be on that.
is this a test?
We're in trouble. No. Okay, 2,500 times 200,000 people. That's a lot of money. And you know what? 10% of that is also a lot of money. But I think you can see by common sense, you've seen the headlines, you know, employers staggered by unprecedented 17% increase in healthcare costs over last year. That's exactly the issue that I think we're talking about.
Ms. Phillips, do you get into the rate stabilization reserves? Is that part of this? What an organization then could do then to hold down a spike? Is that on
That's
top
another
of this?
Name for exactly the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. It's called, for the private, you know, profit-making entities, it's called capital and surplus. For the nonprofits, it's called free reserves. I believe that Doer for the employee pool, which is a similarly sized pool, I think they call it a rate stabilization reserve, and they also have, you know, you need some amount of money so that if things are a little worse than you thought, you aren't turning around and suddenly sending out bills for more money.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, thank you for coming up and being willing to give us some actual numbers, because I know that's something that people are generally hesitant to do. But if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, if a person's health care costs were, say, approximately $2,500 a year, if that was the estimate, mm-hmm. and you were looking at, or maybe just considering then that you'd need maybe around $300 a year in reserve to represent that what you should have to be able to become self-insured. Mm-hmm. So if that particular person paid $100 a year over and above the actual cost of their premium, then in about 3 years you'd have that money at a cost of about $100 per insured person. Is that basically translating what you're saying, or am I way off base?
No, I think that's correct. And if health care costs stayed very predictable and were exactly what we thought they were going to be during that three-year period, then you would have the 3 years to build up your free reserve or your rate stabilization or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, that could happen in the middle of the first year because the school districts, let's say, would be paying in money every month. At the end of 6 months, you might find that that contribution from the school districts is not high enough to cover the actual claims and expenses of the pool. And so, you know, if you look at the $300, and I think that's another good way to look at it, Senator Olson. If I think I can do this one. Let me let me see if I can do this. Okay, so $100 a person would be 20 million times 3 would be 60 million. I would say that you probably would need about double that. I think you'd need about $600 per enrollee. Okay? And in my mind, if you want to make sure there are no problems where doctors and hospitals are not getting paid, and this is a real life scenario. I mean, there have been instances in other states where doctors and hospitals have been billing enrollees because the health plan, for whatever reason, was not paying them, then you really need that kind of money on day one. The only alternative that I can think of would be for the state to say, well, we'll be the backup. You know, we hope nothing goes wrong, but if it does, then the state will come up with that money. But, you know, that's up to you. That's up to you, Senator and Madam Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Gross, anything more? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gross, I wanted to ask a little, because I'm no expert in how insurance companies get started in the state of Minnesota, but my understanding that the role of the Department of Commerce is, you know, a company, let's say someone, an entity, an individual, whatever, business comes into the state of Minnesota, they want to sell insurance here, they want to start up a company. They come to you, you have various, these requirements, these formulas, the risk-based capital, you have certain requirements, and the purpose of that is to protect the consumers so that when a claim is filed, you know, there's the ability to cover that claim. Am I following that correctly? I mean, you have to approve before someone can go into business in the insurance industry in the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, Senator Gerlach, that's correct.
Okay, well, then, Madam Chair and Mr. Gross, then, I'm trying to follow. So now what we're being asked to do here as legislators is we're being asked to set you aside, I see, and approve this plan, this pool, whereby the Department of Commerce will not, whatever standards you follow are being just set aside. Is that a correct statement?
Madam Chairman, Senator Gerlach, that's correct.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I mean, we talked last time. I mean, there's some serious issues about this, and we've drilled down into the reserve issue quite a bit. And, you know, we have a Department of Commerce that serves a purpose, and I mean, we'll get into this further as we get further in the bill, but as long as Mr. Gross is up here, I want to ask him those few questions.
Oh, that's fine.
So thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Gross, did you have something else?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kroonquist. And then I have Mr. Grathwall. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. AMSD is opposed to Senate File 276. We have not, though, Madam Chair, members, arrived at that decision lightly, and not without a great deal of research and really looking into this issue. I'll give you a couple quick examples. Last year, last February, in fact, we held a major policy conference on this topic of health insurance. We invited in a number of guest speakers, ranging from former United States Senator David Durenberger to representatives from the Department of Health, the MMA, the Association of Health Underwriters, and others. And the what we took away from that, what our board took away from that conference, was that while, in fact, pooling certainly has benefits, you know, no one can deny that. There are advantages to pooling. That's the whole concept of insurance, after all. But that there are limits, and that, in fact, there is a point of diminishing return where the increase in the pool size no longer causes a drop in administrative costs or pooling rates. And the other, I think, key issue that we took away was that there are, in fact, other identifiable reasons or causes for controlling your health costs. And they center on the areas of controlling utilization, on implementing things like disease management programs, wellness programs, and educating your employees about the importance of using generic drugs and other cost-saving measures. The other thing that we've done is we invited our colleagues from Education Minnesota to come in and to present their proposal to our board of directors. We wanted to give them that chance because we wanted to make sure that we were not overlooking something because, in fact, if there is a group that is concerned about rising health insurance costs, it's certainly school board members and administrators who, as you know, more often than not over the last decade have been cutting budgets. And if they can do something to control health care costs and try to prevent further cuts in the classroom, they certainly want to do that. But our board remains unconvinced that moving to a statewide mandatory pool will, in fact, achieve the results that our proponents, that the proponents claim it will. And so I guess our primary objection, Madam Chair members, is the mandatory nature of the proposal. We don't believe that evidence has been offered that shows that a statewide voluntary pool cannot work. Now, we know you've heard a lot of statements about just broad statements, just dismissing that, just saying, no, if it's voluntary, it can't work. It'll cause a death spiral, I think, is a word we've heard quite often. In fact, I think if you read the Red and Anders report, you will not find the phrase death spiral in that report. In fact, you will not find anything in that report that says a voluntary pool will not work. The report does say that a voluntary pool might achieve up to 1.5% less cost savings than the mandatory pool, but in fact, it does not say that a voluntary pool is not a viable option. In addition, I would submit, Madam Chair and members, that the proponents of the bill admitted last year that it is not necessary to have a statewide mandatory pool when they supported an amendment in the House that would have exempted the 27 largest school districts in the state from participating in this pool. And that amendment was adopted. It was as part of the House bill. That amendment would have, in fact, exempted 23,000 teachers from participating in the pool. And so, you know, if in fact we'd agree then that it's not necessary to have a statewide mandatory pool, our simple question is, then why would we do that? Finally, Madam Chair, members, I would like to just respond to, I think it was a question that Senator Scogin and Senator Gerlach both posed, and that was, will there be school districts that will in fact see premium increases as a result of moving in this direction? And rather than take my word for it, I would just read from the fiscal note that was prepared for this legislation last year. I haven't seen the new fiscal note, but since the legislation is basically the same, I think this still is applicable. And as you all know, under a fiscal note, there's a section that deals with local government costs. And there's a section in there that reads, while the goal of the pool is to lower health care costs for school districts and school employees, some districts may experience decreased costs and/or improved health care coverage. Others may experience increased costs and/or poorer health care coverage. And we We think that actually just makes common sense, Madam Chair, but it is in writing in the fiscal note. And our concern is that, in fact, the districts that will see the higher premiums and potentially less coverage are going to be those that have actually done the hard work and taken control of their cost and through a collective employee-employer relationship and put cost control measures into place. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Kronquist? Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kronquist, your first point was the one I was trying to make last week, and I'm still getting emails and phone calls from teachers and school board members saying this is mandatory, even though Mr. Johansson said they can opt out. Is this mandatory?
Mr. Kronquist.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think where the confusion might come in is if you offer health insurance, then you have to purchase it through this pool. If you don't offer health insurance, then you don't. So that might be where the confusion comes in.
Senator Betzold, is that your
yes.
understanding? Okay.
If they pay for it, yes.
Okay. Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, I believe the other point to that's important to note is that a particular teacher does not have to take this insurance any more than they would under any other insurance. So if they had insurance through their spouse or just chose not to mm-hmm. be insured, they wouldn't be required to pay in premiums into this pool, correct?
Correct.
Mr. Kronquist, okay. Okay, no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam
Mr.
Chair
Graffal.
Members.
Good evening, Madam Chair members.
Good evening.
Jim Graffal.
Welcome.
Thank you. I represent the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I'd like to thank Senator Betzold for bringing the initiative forward, and regretfully, we still oppose this proposal contained in Senate File 276, and simply because we're one of the districts that shows up in that fiscal notes that I know for a fact that our costs would increase under any proposal that required us to join a statewide mandatory health insurance pool. So it comes down to we believe this would increase cost to our insureds, our teachers, and staff by precluding the current private market decision to write off a portion of our claims experience. That's the situation we're in. We think this proposal duplicates existing pooling options rather than reducing costs. And further, to the extent we pass this and move into a transition, we're going out to bid for insurance, and you place us in an untenable position of no longer having any incentive for anyone in the private market to take us on in that transition period. I just want to note that health insurance premiums continue to rise because health care costs, insureds' use, and claims experience continue to grow. The problem of rising health care costs is universal in every sector of this economy. And a solution to the problem of rising health care costs should attack cost drivers directly. Attacking those cost drivers directly would look something like improving the health and health care outcomes of the insureds to reduce the cost of health insurance and health care service. The statewide health pool proposal in front of you doesn't reduce health care costs, use, or improve health care outcomes for insureds. Rather, this solution simply duplicates existing pooling options, either through PEEP, Blue Cross Blue Shield, service co-ops, or direct service from a major provider. Proponents of the bills have already stated that they initially expect to rent a provider network from one of the major providers. In healthcare and in housing, renting is more expensive than owning. Finally, we do not believe the best solution for a plan design that will reduce health insurance costs and improve the health of the insured is to remove health benefits from the 340 or so individual bargaining units' collective bargaining process and place plan design in the hands of 14 appointees. We don't think that's a solution that works. In closing, we believe this proposal solves a collective bargaining problem, not a health insurance problem. Separating the negotiation of health benefits and salaries prevents local bargaining processes from weighing health care cost increases and local wage increases. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Grethwell? Mr. Grethwell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bob Johnson, or Mr. Sposetto, did you? You want to come up together, I can tell. Good evening, gentlemen. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think I'll start off. I'm Dominic Sposetto. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and also the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. Together, we have about 6,000 licensed agents throughout the state. And let me say this right off the bat, the overwhelming majority of them do not sell health insurance to school districts. It's a fairly specialized market, and a few of our members involved, but the majority are not. However, as organizations that are interested in health insurance in Minnesota and how it affects small employers and individuals throughout the state, we do have some concerns about this particular proposal. I don't think I need to reiterate the concerns about the reserves and the need for reinsurance and also what happens in an insolvency situation. Who picks up the tab? Is it the local school district? Is it the state general revenues? It's a concern that I think you as public policy officials should really very, very hard consider very diligently, because that is an exposure that's out there that is not out there in the traditional marketplace because of the reserving requirements required by the Commerce Department. I will say that Education Minnesota has taken some strides over their previous proposals by including MSHA assessments and premium tax assessments as well. However, they are limited to a certain extent, and again, it differs from what is out there for other small employers who would love to have some sort of a limited exposure to those taxes. And I think what I'd really like to say is that whatever you do with this group is going to affect all the other groups in the state. I mean, there is a total picture here, and by taking a certain segment of the population out and treating them differently, it still affects everybody else that's out there. No matter how you re-pool or rearrange this issue, pooling is not the only answer. The answer is the growing health care costs, and there's not much in here that does cost containment, other than the initial savings through a repooling tool. And I also say that by setting up this particular plan, it seems to run counter to what's going on in the private marketplace, which is more consumer-driven health care. We're seeing higher co-payments and higher deductibles as a way for employers to maintain health insurance for their employees by sharing some of the costs. And there are even some economic arguments to make it go that way. And we're afraid that this particular proposal runs counter to that kind of trend. So I would encourage you to be cautious as you move forward on this proposal. Keep in mind, if this doesn't work, we won't be able to reconfigure what we have now, which is a fairly competitive marketplace among self-insurance and service cooperatives and individual indemnity carriers. The best way to go, in my mind, is to make this an optional program. It's another option, so we at least maintain that current marketplace that's out there, because if we go full tilt to a mandatory pool, that will eliminate what's out there now, and we won't be able to go back. With that, Madam Chairman, I'll turn it over to Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Pizzetto, thank you. Mr. Johnson, good evening.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Brevity is the key on Monday night at this time.
Yes.
I don't want to be repetitive, so about two or three points. And actually, I'll just pose them as questions, really, as Dominic has indicated. But this is an area where, from my members and the companies, we're in agreement with the agents of the state. And a week ago or so, I had an opportunity to walk through this chart that had basics of insurance and the chapters of Minnesota law. And while it says 59A to 79A, there's actually about 66 chapters in there, because there's a 60 A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S. I think it's down to T.
Wow.
But the point is this. Here's the question. If we think this is good for Minnesotans, and actually about a third of these chapters, I counted them, are health care. That's about 20 or so.
Mr. Johnson, I just refreshed members. This is what he presented when he did Insurance 101 and told us all of the
And just tried to relate. And so my question is this. If we think that this is good public policy for Minnesotans in health care, and if Bob's transmission out in Osseo buys a policy, the 20 chapters apply to that policy. So I think we do think it's good public policy. This bill is not that. In fact, these chapters are not applicable at all, with a couple of exceptions, and the key ones that are not covered. Page 3 of the bill, the paragraph E, lines 3.13 to 3.15, there's three lines in the bill that deal with claim reserves, stabilization reserves, reinsurance, and other features that, in the judgment of the board, will result in long-term stability and solvency of the health plans. And the department has already really talked about why we have established public policy, financial requirements, capital requirements, and reserve requirements. We have it there because we want the plans to be able to pay for health claims when they're coming due. And so, really, I think if we think this is good public policy, our health care boat and the Minnesotans that are covered by these laws, we know, continues to shrink. The exodus out is growing. We're reaching this dysfunctional place in state law. We all know that's true. A dysfunctional place in state law where who's covered by this, we're losing the law of large numbers. We talked about pooling and the law of large numbers. We're losing it in the regulated health care market. And it's just ironic. It's unfortunate because, you know, maybe we should let, maybe here's the second question I'd ask. Maybe why don't we have a bill that lets private companies form in Minnesota, private health care companies, and let them comply with lines 3.13 to 3.15 on page 3 of this bill, where in the judgment of the board of the private health care company, they decide what's necessary for claim reserves, stabilization, reinsurance. The department is probably taking a deep breath behind me, Julia, because that erases. That erases the chapters in here that we've, through the years, worked on. And if we do that, you'll have more choices in the market. I can guarantee you that. If you did what I just suggested, and it maybe would happen pretty quickly. So all I'm suggesting, Madam Chair, I'm asking questions. I think from an industry's perspective, we've worked with you in the legislature, the executive branch, and the commissioners through the years, really on a bipartisan basis, almost without, you know, with few exceptions, to pass these laws for the reasons of the solvency and the protection and the safeguard of the claims, the companies that they're there. If they go broke, that the claims are paid by the mechanisms that are in place. And, Madam Chair, I just think that these are questions. They're fair questions to ask. As Dominic indicated, it diminishes the market when we pull out chunks of Minnesotans out of the regulated market. And it's raising the jeopardy level of kind of the viability, the functioning. How small a base are we going to make the policies that are assessed for the AMCHA, the $100 million plus AMCHA deficit? How small are we going to shrink this base? So we're on individuals and small group. The groups least able to afford the subsidy are the only ones that pay it. And I can envision the day soon where we're going to have the small number of policies. And the good news is that their health care premium is maybe only $10,000. The bad news is that their AMCHA assessment might be $10 million. You know, you do reach a point where that maybe sounds silly, but that actually is what the system we have, and people are exiting the base because it's legal to exit the base. So, Madam Chair, I don't want to belabor that. I think these are fair questions to ask. I think these are legitimate questions to pose about the bill and how it squares with current state law. We think these laws, actually, we support them. They're good public policy, and they serve a purpose for Minnesotans, and we think we ought to continue to utilize them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson, thank you. Senator Olson, did you have a comment or a question for Mr. Johnson?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm confused at this point because I thought we heard at the beginning of this evening that this pool, because it's a government pool, would be subject to state regulation as compared to, say, an ERISA self-insured plan, which I think right now, I think I heard in one committee meeting about 40% of the plans in the state right now are ERISA plans. Do you know if that, does it, you're shaking your head, that's about true. And they're not subject to state regulation at all, and specifically consumer protection laws. Whereas my understanding is that this plan from what I just heard at the beginning of the night, would be subject to state law compared to all those other private plans, and that the actual insureds under this would have more consumer protection and more be more subject to state regulation than that other 40% that's out there.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator,
Johnson.
Yeah, there's no question that what laws this plan, this pool would be subject to are specified on the face of the bill. That makes this plan different than a pure ERISA plan. So you're correct. To the extent Senate File 276 specifies that it must comply with Chapter 62Q or 62, that makes it subject to that law, not all the state laws. And as the department testified already even tonight, there are a block of state financial regulation, solvency, capitalization that this is not subject to. So the answer is that it's hybrid, as you described accurately, but it's only subject to those chapters that are specified on the face of this.
I think that what Mr. Gross was telling us was that the state has the authority in, is it 471 or 400-something, where there's more than one governmental unit, the state has the ability to regulate it. But it's not an automatic.
It would,
and Mr. Gross, maybe you could nod or else tell me. Am I correct? Unless it's specifically iterated in the bill, there isn't authority for the state or not? I don't know if that's getting to the bottom line here, Senator Olson, or not, but Mr. Gross.
Madam Chairman, Senator Olson, let me try to clarify this. There are certain statutes. It's on line 3.8 is specifically cites specific statutes, specific chapters that this pool would have to comply with. The concern that we raised was on the fact that it's not subject to the reserving requirements. I mean, if you look in chapter 60A, that's where you start with reserving risk-based capital. That's not cited there. Now, if they put that in there, then we would have some authority to make sure that this entity would meet the risk-based capital requirements. But because it's out, they don't have to do that. They certainly will have to, as it's cited here on line 3.8, they will certainly have to put all the health care mandates that are required by some of the statutes. Bob Johnson is citing some of the other statutes. Like, for example, there's fair trade statutes that are found in Chapter 72A. Those are not cited here. We could add more here if you want to get more consumer protection, but then I would assume the authors, Senator Betzel and the Education Minnesota might have some problems with some of that, more regulation and stuff like that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grossen. Senator Olson, do you have another question?
No, Madam Chair. I guess I just wanted to make the point that I think there is more regulation than for the other 40% of the self-insured plans in this plan. And so to say that somehow they're getting special treatment, they're actually going to be more regulated by state law than all the other self-insured plans, I think, that we already have in the state. Because that was my...
Well, I think so, Senator Olson. I think the issue, though, is that they're not like any other entity. It's not like 3M with assets or the state of Minnesota that has the ability, you know, to cover mm-hmm. a loss or the reserve. I mean, they don't have an automatic... There's no one entity. I mean, Education Minnesota itself doesn't have the assets. The individual districts, it's hard to argue that they do as well. Buildings, teachers, you know,
well,
I mean, they don't have very liquid assets to cover.
But, Madam Chair, isn't that why they would have, I mean, eventually they're going to initially be purchasing policies and then eventually they would have a reserve built up? Because we have so many companies in the state doing this, they're not all 3M. I mean, a lot of them are small companies that don't have anywhere near the assets that a 3M would have. And yet, as long as they meet the reserve requirements, they're
Well, I think, Senator Olson, that the point is that there is no reserve requirement in here, and that's the point these gentlemen are making and that Ms. Phillips was making.
Then I guess I'm confused, Madam Chair. Won't there have to be a reserve before they could become self-insured?
Senator Olson, there's nothing in here that says that. I believe that's what their intent is, but there's nothing in here that says that.
Okay.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if Mr. Johnson can answer this or if Mr. Gross needs to come back to the table, but I'm not certain whether this plan also is required through its premiums to pay into MSHA or the provider fee that goes into the Health Care Access Fund.
Do you want to answer? Maybe Mr.
Stain
can answer that.
Madam Chair, I think it might have been somewhat alluded to earlier, but there are a couple provisions in here which do make this new employee pool subject to MSHA and the premium tax. However, it's kind of a formula which was established by an actuary to hold these funds harmless at a blended rate, because right now, effectively, some of the school districts are paying this and some are not. So there is an assessment here, but I think somebody mentioned it at the rate of roughly one-third of what the full tax is on that, and that's about right.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Mr. Griffin, and we're winding down here. We're just going to have a couple more people.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak. I'm feeling more like I'm winding up rather than winding down.
Oh, no.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Betzel, my name is Phil Griffin. I am a lobbyist appearing this evening on behalf of Preferred One, but also on behalf of the 8 members of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the nonprofit HMOs in this state. You've heard already a number of items tonight, and I hate to repeat them, but I think they are very important. And I want to start with what is the tantamount and most important point, which is the issue that you've been discussing surrounding insolvency. We believe that Senate File 276 increases the risks of insolvency in the health plan that's being designed under this legislation. The number one reason why so many pools have failed in Minnesota and in the rest of the country is because reserves are not adequately funded. According to the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, as you've heard Ms. Phillips describe, reserves should be set at 20 to 25% of expected claims to ensure financial viability. The actuarial study done for this proposal recommends setting aside less than 10%. And, Madam Chair, I want to just stop off a little bit because Senator Gerlach said he's not in the business of establishing a health plan. And in 1994, when I left Medica Health Plan and went to Preferred One, I spent 2 years trying to get a license for Preferred One to become a health maintenance organization in this state. And it wasn't for lack of trying. It was for lack of reserves. And I hear the department snickering behind me, but we had the statutorily required money in a cashier's check ready to deposit in the bank. And the only way that we received a license in this state was to get from our owners, that is North Memorial Healthcare and Fairview Health Services, a guarantee, letter guarantee signed for the commissioner for $20 million to get that license. They would not give us a license until we got that. And that was because the department was concerned about the issue that you've been discussing tonight. What happens when you establish a pool and you don't have enough reserves in the event that there is some kind of a catastrophic health care event? And it doesn't take much, Madam Chair. Preferred One saw this fall a $3 million individual, a premature infant at a neonatal intensive care unit here in the Twin Cities. It is very easy these days to see these kinds of health care costs go up. If the pool becomes insolvent, you've heard the question raised already this evening, but I'll raise it again. Who will pay the claims? You've specifically exempted the state from doing it. There is no entity back behind it. And if a fully insured group goes uninsured, there is a backup. It's the health plan and its reserves. And if that goes bankrupt, there's another issue behind that. And that is, do we go into the MSHA assessment, which then backs up to all the health plans, or if it's an insurance company, which all of our companies have insurance companies as well, it goes into a guarantee fund. And I think Senator Scheid and Senator Metzen are the only ones that are still on the committee that were here when we saw Executive Life go bankrupt on the national level. But that impact rippled through all of the health plans here in Minnesota who had to pay into the guarantee fund. This proposal does not assure that there will be any money available for the first days of operation. Minnesota Statutes Chapter 62D.042 requires an initial net worth as a condition of licensure, and that requirement has been left out of Senate File 276 and is contrary to the actual requirements imposed on other health plans and insurers in Minnesota. The legislation does not address how the reserves will be established. Presumably, each school district will be assessed an amount to include in reserves. Schools that are currently fully insured are not required to pay into a reserve account because they are not at financial risk for their claims. Having to fund a reserve pool will be a financial hardship to many schools. You cannot simply go into this business and say we're going to be fully insured to start with and at some later date become self-insured and take the reserves away from the insurance companies and put them into some new reserve system that you're going to have. Service cooperatives will need to keep their reserves, and that would have a significant negative impact for schools and the current cooperatives if you change that. We also believe that this creates adverse selection. School districts are a unique risk pool that need to be carefully considered due to higher utilization, as you've heard described by the proponents of the legislation, and demographics. School districts are on average about 10% higher than the typical risk pool. By pooling all school districts together, segregating them from the other healthy pools within our insurance companies, you will create a situation where individuals who are healthy or have more affordable coverage available to them through a spouse will leave the district coverage altogether. Because this legislation does not require all employees to stay in the pool, it is likely that you will end up with what you've heard described as a death spiral. Senate File 276 sets up a system where the incentive is only for the sicker, higher-cost groups to participate, not the entire population of teachers in Minnesota. As a result, the cost for coverage will be higher for those in the system, eventually causing that death spiral. Healthier districts will not participate. All of the decisions still come down to the local bargaining unit. There will be teachers in local bargaining units who would rather receive cash in lieu because they can obtain health care coverage at a lower rate elsewhere. I want to emphasize the question that Senator Olson just addressed, which was, do we apply the statutes that are in state law currently to this new pool? And we would say that, yes, you do apply some of them, but not all of them. And it's very important that you recognize that when you apply, as you do in the legislation, Chapter 62A and 62C, you're applying them to the policies, but not to the entity that governs them. And that's the distinction that you need to make. If you want to get at reserves and covering this big institution, you need to bring them into something like Chapter 62D, which regulates the HMOs. 62D.04, which has that certificate of authority for minimum reserve requirements. 62D.041, which has consumer protections in the event of insolvency. 0.042, the net worth requirements. 0.044, something we had huge arguments over in 1988 when we first established the reserve requirements for HMOs. What can be admitted assets for a health plan? What can be admitted assets so that you know what you're counting is actually worth something rather than worthless? And I could go on about the other things that aren't included, but I won't. They're another 10 chapters or so. As you heard Mr. Grathwald talk about this and Mr. Kronquist, this does not address the cost of any savings that really need to accrue to health care to control costs. Pooling doesn't by itself lower costs other than initially one time. The issues that we need to deal with are increased utilization of health care services, the rates that we pay providers, the increasing technology of yours truly's little leg that 20 years ago they would have said you got a bum knee. After $10,000, I can golf 4 days later, but that's nothing compared to my brother's liver transplant, which was over $1 million. It takes a lot of $10,000 a year treatments, family premiums to take care of that kind of a treatment. We need to address the inefficiencies of the system. I don't think we can address the aging population, and I'm happy to report Senator Metzen's committee reporting out on the Freedom to Breathe Act today. Those lifestyle changes are something that can really do something to control health care costs. This proposal merely shifts around money rather than creating true savings. We think the proposal's claim to save over $223 million over a six-year period is overstated. You've already heard about the MCHA assessment, and I won't belabor that other than to say none of us are allowed to cap the assessments that we pay to MCHA. This bill allows them to do that both for MCHA and for premium taxes, both of which will continue to rise on the rest of the market that pays them. Madam Chair, when I talked about our world of trying to establish a health plan, a preferred one, I talked about the funding that we had to come up with in the private market. We would have loved to have the state give us $5 million to start our health plan. We didn't come to the state and ask for it, and we don't think it's appropriate for somebody who's going to be competing with us to come and do it either. We would also point out, as Mr. Kernquist pointed out, there is no insurance expertise on the governing board. We believe that you want to have both a combination of insurance expertise and consumers, which is something that we have as a requirement of state law on the board of all the health maintenance organizations. We believe that you can fix this legislation as you move forward. We don't think the proponents will like some of the fixes that we have, but we would suggest and we've drafted an amendment if the committee sees fit to adopt it. It would meet the same financial solvency protection requirements as licensed insurers. It would have the same adequate reserves. They would have to do the same reporting that we have to do on a quarterly basis. It would have to contain all of the consumer protections afforded to all other citizens of the state of Minnesota, and it would have to have the same level benefits and mandates currently required by fully insured products regulated by the Department of Commerce and the Department of Health. It would provide the same levels of quality assurance and quality improvement, things that we've spent a great deal of time and money trying to work on here in the state of Minnesota. It would require the full payment of the full assessment for MCHA and the Minnesota Care Premium Tax. And that's not the Minnesota Care Tax, that's the Minnesota Care Premium Tax. The subject would also be subject to prior, the proposal would also be subject to prior approval from the Commissioner of Commerce. Madam Chair and members, I apologize for the length of the my testimony on this legislation. I can't tell you how important this is to Preferred One. And my employer said, as I spoke to him on the phone, to tell you today that if you're not afraid of this legislation, you haven't looked at it closely enough. Madam Chair and members, if there are questions, I would be happy to address them, and thank you for your time.
Any questions for Mr. Griffin? Mr. Griffin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Schwab? Welcome back. Good evening.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every single school district in the state of Minnesota. We're here tonight to give you a little background on collective bargaining. It's usually done between the school board and the teacher union, and they come up with a benefits wage plan for every school district in the state of Minnesota. They are not at all uniform, but really done locally. And I was happy to introduce Superintendent Williams from Rochester on our last hearing, and he did a wonderful job of explaining what Rochester has done all on its own to provide quality health care for their employees in our present system. I have two teachers with me tonight, Denny and George, who will explain the success they've had in their own communities providing a health plan members.
Good evening. Madam Chair and members, my name is George Kramer, and I'm here representing the district employees of Watertown Mayor Schools. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in opposition to mandatory statewide health insurance legislation. Watertown Mayor is a small district just west of the Twin Cities. We're part of a regional co-op of several schools joined together to purchase health insurance and a variety of other services. How has the cooperative helped our district? The pool is self-insured and isn't required to pay health insurance taxes. Avoiding these taxes, by the way, was the source of savings for Education Minnesota's initial proposal. Ironically, the legislation before you includes payment of some of these taxes, which means an increase in cost to our district right off the bat. Getting back to the regional co-op, pooling has helped stabilize rates in a time of double-digit rate increases. We had several years with an average increase of only 8%. During that time, we could have had even lower increases, but we helped those co-op members with large claims lower their rates. The last contract year, Watertown Mayor would have had a 20% increase. The pool reduced this to 17%. The regional cooperative also works with their members to tailor a program that best suits their members' needs. We work with the co-op to find ways to reduce that 17% increase to 10%. That was more close to the average for most districts. The change was accomplished by changing the prescription drug copay to free generics and $40 and $60 copays for brand name prescriptions. Most prescriptions are bought 80% now or can be bought generic. The regional co-op also seeks new ways to maximize premium dollars, a program that is used by Target and other large corporations to reward those clinics that perform best, with patients having chronic diabetes and pulmonary disease, was recently adopted by the co-op. The cost is $30,000 per year, with an anticipated savings of $30,000 to $90,000 per year. Wellness is another area that receives attention within the co-op. Watertown Mayor Wellness Committee supports activities for all staff that encourage healthy living. More than 20 staff members are attending Weight Watchers meeting each week, including me. So, a community-wide triathlon was run last fall, and other healthy activities are planned each week. So wellness is a key part to this whole plan. Regional pools have been an effective way to help school districts control rapidly rising health insurance premiums. The members of the pool can make decisions that help keep costs down for all members or to tailor their own plan to meet the changing needs within their own districts, much like we did this year. Education Minnesota's proposal is built on the concept of pooling. However, pooling is already being done on a regional basis, and we have ownership of the program at that level. We don't need a statewide committee to recreate what we are already doing in our region. The best solution might be to find a way to bring the six or so districts that have dropped insurance coverage into their regional pools. The structure already exists, and it would minimize any additional risk that the state of Minnesota might have if a statewide pool is enacted. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Kramer, thank you. Any questions? Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Chair Scheid, committee members, earlier I heard someone say common sense. And what I want to speak for a short time about here.
Who are you?
I need to know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm Dennis Fent. I'm a teacher, have been a teacher since 1973. I teach in North St. Paul Maplewood.
What's your last name? I'm sorry.
Fent. I'm also the president of the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale Teachers Union. Excuse me for that. As I started to say, I want to talk a little bit about common sense, and I do appreciate the opportunity to be here. First of all, let me simply address the question of health care crisis that we seem to be dealing with here. I would readily agree with those who feel that we have significant health care issues in Minnesota and, in fact, in the nation as a whole. When we have 47 million Americans, as I hear on the news, without health care in our country, that seems to rise to the level of a crisis in my mind. When we have infants, children, the elderly, and far too many average citizens in Minnesota without health care, that seems to suggest to me that something needs to be done. In fact, I would be one of the first to suggest that both the state of Minnesota and the federal government need to do something sooner rather than later about this issue. On the other hand, our Minnesota legislature has spent already an inordinate amount of time over the last several years debating a statewide health insurance plan for all school employees. That is flawed in so many ways and, in fact, appears to be politically motivated rather than good public policy. Now, why do I say that? First of all, to mandate a on all of our school districts, whether they want it or not, does not seem like good public policy to me. Furthermore, to mandate a plan upon these districts that has no defined plan design seems totally foolhardy to me. And then to mandate this undefined plan with no premium costs attached seems completely absurd. Can this really be about your business of legislating good public policy? From the original study, which I will admit is severely outdated at this point, we know there will be winners and losers if this plan is implemented. What will that plan look like for those mandated into it? No one knows. What will this plan cost the district and the employees who will be mandated into it? No one knows. Can that possibly be good public policy? Maybe the specifics of the plan should be shared with the general public, with the school districts, with all the employees before this proposal moves forward any further. Maybe the specific costs attached to this proposal should be shared with the general public, with all the school districts, and with all the employees being mandated into it. That would seem to me to make for much better public policy and probably even make for a much more democratic process that can stand the light of day and the light of public scrutiny. Here is our current summary plan description. It looks like this. I'm sure you've seen many of them. It's multi-paged. That is what we currently operate under. Any member that wants to know what's covered, what it will cost, what's involved, goes to the summary plan design. It's spelled out. Here's the directory for our current plan. It has all of the providers, where one can go, who one can see for this issue, that issue. That is all available to any school district or employee that currently has insurance. And, of course, they study that before they sign on and pay premiums to a health care provider. Now, the problem as we see it in our members is, where is that same information with the current proposed statewide health insurance? I would submit to you it looks something like this. With the current plan, we have no plan design, we have no premium costs, and yet we are talking about mandating 200,000 school employees into it. Again, that would seem totally absurd to me. When we look at our plan, all of it comes with premium costs attached. Would it really be good public policy to mandate anyone, not to mention all school districts and all school employees, into this with less than what we have here? Show us, please, complete plan design for any proposal with complete premium costs attached. And then everyone can truly examine what it is that we would be mandated into. Until that is done, let us stop debating this issue that has gone on for years. In listening to testimony last week in front of this committee, I heard that 81% of those surveyed on this topic supported it. In the years that the legislature has been debating this proposal, I have not found a single person who has participated in one of these surveys. And believe me, I have asked numerous members. Did the survey go to the 200,000 people who will be mandated into this pool? Did it even go to the 70,000 members of Ed Minnesota? Was it a random sample of 50,000 or 20,000 or 1,000 or 100 or 10? Who knows? What were these survey participants asked and what was explained to them about the plan? Very few people have any understanding of what a statewide health insurance proposal even is. Many believe, in fact, that it will be a state-paid-for plan that will cover the costs of health insurance for all school employees. I could see why that would get an 81% approval. Again, before this discussion goes any further, let us see the survey, let us see the plan designs, let us see the attached costs. Let us see what information was provided to those who received this survey. In conclusion, if we are going to mandate this proposal upon all school districts and all school employees, would we not first insist that all those involved would have a clear, concise understanding of what is being mandated upon them and then let them respond to it with full understanding and a complete awareness of what is being proposed before we mandate that upon them. That would seem to me is what makes for good public policy in what we hope is our most democratic society. Thank you very much.
Mr. Fendt, thank you. I think in all fairness, I believe that the proponents of this intend to develop those plans. I don't think that they, you know,
we certainly hope so.
Paper and in black and white. I'm sure that members would have access to the, you know, the same kind of information before they chose a plan. I think they're asking for 6 plans to be approved. So, and members would have the same kind of material that you're showing there. And are there any questions, members? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you for coming here this evening. Ms. Gruber? Ms. Gruber, welcome. It's good to see you again.
Good evening, Madam Chair. So good to see you and committee members. I know it's the hour is late. I'll make this very brief. My name's Lynn Gruber. I'm the president of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, MCHA, MCHA. It has some acronyms. Very briefly, for those that are new or may not have remembered about MCHA, we are considered the state's high-risk pool, basically for individuals who are seeking individual coverage but get turned down in the private market because they have a pre-existing condition. Legislature put us together in 1976 as a nonprofit corporation. We are not a state agency. We are not funded by the state of Minnesota generally, and we have about 30,000 members throughout the state of Minnesota. In terms of this bill, I represent our board of directors, and I am not here to address the pros or cons of the bill itself, but to look at one section of the bill, and Mr. Stang pointed that out, which is Section 4. It has to do with whether or not this new entity, should you approve it, would be paying the MCHA assessment. Now, having said that, let me explain how we run the pool. There are 2 sources of revenue for us. Premiums that we collect from our members that are above market. They're allowed to be between basically 101 and 125% of the average individual premium in the state of Minnesota. Right now they're running at about 123% of that average. Well, that gives us about 50% of what we need to run the pool. And our pool is valued at, in terms of the claims we pay, at about $230 million. The other portion of the funds that we need to run the pool come from an assessment that was laid out in state statute back in the late 70s. And basically what the assessment says is if you are a contributing member of MCHA, and the bill addresses contributing members, you will pay your portion of MCHA's losses in direct proportion of your market share of total health insurance premium. Now, when they created the bill in their wisdom, in 76, they included all self-insured entities because the ERISA bill had not, the regs and rules had not been developed. ERISA was, I think, passed in 74. We were created in 76. So through time, as ERISA has developed, you all know what has happened, and that is that if you are a non-governmental self-insured organization, like a 3M or Finger Hut or Pillsbury, and you have a self-insured plan for your employees, you are exempt from paying the MCHA assessment, the premium taxes, and so forth. Through the years, our base, as Mr. Griffin mentioned, I think, or maybe it was Mr. Johnson, has shrunk. So now we have maybe 200 and some companies that actually sell an insured product in the market. What those folks do once they are assessed is they take that assessment, and basically we have in the room here represented Blue Cross, Health Partners, Medica, Preferred One. Those are the major payers of our assessment because they have the most, they sell the most premium in the state of Minnesota. The assessments are paid in direct proportion to their market share. What I would say in terms of looking at the drafting of Section 4, Sub 5, Clause B, is that indeed the assessment would be limited in payment by this new entity, don't think that is good public policy. MCHA serves the entire state of Minnesota. We have members of MCHA that have come to us from self-insured companies that happen to limit their lifetime maxes. Our lifetime max is now about $2.8 million. Further on in session, we are going to seek a bill that will raise that lifetime max to $5.8 million. So we are a safety net, if you will, to many different directions and many different avenues coming to us from not only self-insureds, but companies that go bankrupt and so forth. So my point is, we don't think this is sufficient. We think that if you're going to be a new entity with 200,000 lives, you should be paying the assessment in direct proportion to what that, basically not premium, but contribution would represent. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Ms. Gruber, thank you. Mm-hmm. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Ms. Gruber, have you had any teachers coming to the MSHA program because they lost their insurance through it becoming, because of the experience of their particular mm-hmm. district, too expensive for them to maintain insurance?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I'm not sure of that. We can certainly find out, but that would be hard for me to find out because the application doesn't really explain you know, where you come from, if you're what your position is, let's put it that way, what your occupation is.
Senator Olson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just about called him madam.
One of the things that this pool would do, assuming that's the case, and I think maybe we could provide, if there are, you know, probably something we could find out, because this pool is going to accept everyone, it might, if that's true, take some pressure off claims that are being subsidized partially through state dollars through the MSHA program, if that were the case.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'm not sure if that's true at all.
Okay. I don't know either.
Thanks, Senator. I think, you know, the point that I'm trying to make is that the state of Minnesota decided to go self-insured a few years ago, so there goes another chip of spreading our assessment broadly as the designers of this initially put our pool together. Everybody would pay, and that truly is where we need to get back to. We need to find a broad way to pay for MCHA, and this bill would limit the assessment of this particular group.
Senator Olson or Senator Gerlach? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I understand this because I guess the way the NSHA assessment worked was different. I thought it was a set rate, but it sounds like it varies. That's what I'm learning now, that it varies. So if I'm understanding this correctly, Ms. Gruber, you whatever the losses are for the year, you said you take the market share, you divide that out. This bill has it's got a specific 0.36% of gross premiums, and it's set and locked in. So my understanding that you're saying that because they're not fully participating in the true costs of MCHA, that they're locking in a particular rate? Mm-hmm. Is that?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Gruber,
Senator Gerlach, first of all, are you sure you're on Section 4, Sub 5, Item B? Because it's a three-prong formula there. I think you're looking at the premium tax, which
yes,
is on the page. But nevertheless,
something.
What we're talking about is very close, 0.3885
okay.
on line 5.30 on page 5 of the bill. See that?
So, okay.
It doesn't really matter for purposes of our discussion tonight, because what it does is it does cap the responsibility, let's put it that way, of this new entity. And just to go over one more time, it's a good question, Senator Gerlach. The way the assessments are set out in statute now is that we are going to have probably $110 million worth of losses for 2007. We survey the market, the insured market, in May of that year, and we ask them what was their previous year's premium, gross, group, individual, not property and casualty. This is all health and accident insurance. When we find out what percentage of that big base, which is going to be $5 billion or so, they have, let's say Blue Cross has 35% of market, they will pay 35% of $110 million. So it will vary, but the formula is always the same. This would basically limit you know, to about a third, let's put it that way, of what the rest of the members are paying.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Gruber, is there any other entity in the state of Minnesota that would have a cap? I mean, if they're, you know, the ones that are out of it, the ERISA plans, but of those that are participating and paying members into MCHA, is there any other entity that has a cap?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, good question. No, no, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Scheid, I think, has indicated he'd like to.
Okay, Mr. Johansson.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Johansson. I'm with Education Minnesota. I'd like to spend a little time talking about how we arrived at the current provisions that are in the MCHA section of the bill. As you all are well aware, and as I'm sorry, I can't remember your name.
Lynn Gruber.
Lynn Gruber. As Ms. Gruber testified, in Minnesota, self-insured pools, such as the state employee pool, for instance, and the Anoka-Hennepin School and the Rochester School that you heard from before, are exempt from MCHA assessments. Under the original proposal, and as I testified to last week, it is the intention of the school employees insurance pool to move towards becoming fully self-insured. If this provision were not in the statute, if this provision were not in the bill, at the point we became fully self-insured, we would not pay MCHA anything. We would be exempt. And so what we did, because a concern was raised by MCHA that they would be losing revenue if we did this, is we agreed to MCHA's concern. And we created a hybrid where we would hold our members and we would hold MCHA harmless by continuing to pay roughly in the same proportion as school employees currently pay the MCHA assessment. To bring this up at this point is frustrating, because in fact we've attempted to do everything we can to make certain that MCHA was held harmless and our employees were held harmless. If we have to pay the full assessment when we're fully insured, then in order for there to be justice, we should be totally exempt, as the other self-insureds are, when we move to self-insurance. That was a big objection for MCHA. We addressed MCHA's concern, and I don't think we should have to address it again.
Thank you, Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that, I mean, it's clear that that's what this says, although it's hard to, when you see the number on page 5.30, you don't know exactly what it means, but it is intended that that would continue. And so Mr. Johansson's right, they would continue to pay even after they become fully insured. So, and I recall the discussion when there was, we were not going to have you paying into MCHA. So in the last year or two, we had that discussion. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer an amendment.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one remark?
Sure, Ms.
Madam
Kruger,
Chair, yep. I appreciate that. I think my point was made, and my point is, number one, governmental units aren't necessarily exempt. It's the legislature that can make them exempt. You aren't automatically exempt. So Mr. Johansson and I disagree. Number two, that here's more chipping away at the problem of MCHA's shrinking assessment base. So not to, you know, split hairs, but what I'm trying to do is make the point that as we see the suggestion in this bill that they will possibly go self-insured, you know, the nose of the camel is under the tent. Once they're fully insured or self-insured, there will be no assessment paid. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Gruber. Thank you to all our testifiers. I think we've had some really good testimony on both sides, several hours, and members hang on because we do have some amendments here. With that, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A1 manager. I'm tired. The other day I asked somebody if they were married. That was misinterpreted. Now I'm asking the manager. I'm just having trouble all over the place. No, I know. I know Senator Sparks is married. So, the A1, and I know Senator Betzold would want to see it. And members, obviously, we've all talked to a lot of people about this legislation. We are stepping out in new ground here. There's no question about that. But, and I think that, you know, this isn't the education committee. I serve on the E-12 budget division. I happen to think that teachers and people who educate our children, who care for our children in the school system, are about the most important people that we have in our society in Minnesota in terms of our future. And I believe that they are not overpaid. I think that we're falling behind. I think that in terms of pay of teachers around the country, I think our pay has slipped. We owe it to teachers, I think, to do something to help here where we can. I have a concern, however, that the Department of Commerce should be involved in the development of the plans and the oversight. I've had some discussion with the people from Education Minnesota. I know they would rather have more consultation. I believe the department will want to make this work because the legislative intent is there in this legislation. If we pass this bill, we intend that there be the statewide pool and that the department will be obligated to make that happen in the most prudent, fiscally sound way. And that's my concern here. And I think it's a concern expressed by others. And so I would ask, I think the significant language is probably that at the bottom of the Amendment 119, the department must approve all design elements. That comes after language that deals with reserves, stabilization reserves, reinsurance, and other features that are part that the board would consider. So it's not a veto power on the board. You know, I think some people have suggested that that's important. I want the department to be involved in the development of these plans, and they are in terms of the six plans. They would have to give approval to that, but this is also then the elements of how the plan will work statewide. And so if you have any questions, I would try to answer that. But I think, Mr. Stang, have I pretty much described that, other than the definitional thing of health plan and health benefit plans?
Mr. Stang.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think Senator Scheid described the most significant part of the amendment. There's also a requirement, if you look on the bill on page 3, line 8, that talks about the board of this entity being able to set plans and premium rates by geography. This amendment would also require the Department of Commerce to approve that as well. So I think those are the two main new areas of oversight by Commerce under this amendment.
Okay. Further discussion on the A1 amendment. Senator Olson.
And then Pennsylvania.
Senator Scheid, my question is, you said there's no veto power in this amendment. And I'm just wondering, the language on line 19 that talks about they must approve all design elements. If they just didn't approve any of the elements of the plan, wouldn't that be, in effect, a way for them to veto the implementation of this plan?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, what I said was they didn't want them to have a veto power on the board. They wouldn't be a member of the board.
Okay.
That's what I meant to imply. I think technically you're correct, although... And I don't want to say that the department has never not enforced the law, but I happen to have carried a bill once that the department didn't enforce. Not this department, but it was the Department of Commerce, but it a few years ago. But I believe that the legislative intent here is strong and that we are establishing a statewide plan, and the department would work with Education Minnesota, and with that board, with that governing board. I shouldn't say with Education Minnesota, but with the school employee insurance board, to develop a plan that meets fundamental requirements, I think, that we would want them to do in terms of fiscal responsibility and soundness of the plan. having to do, particularly with reserves, because that has been a question I think that's legitimately asked. We haven't trod on this ground before.
Thank you, Senator. The author of the bill, Senator Betzold.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid. Mr. Gross raised some good points when he talked about the fact that they would not know whether the reserves are sufficient that the board is establishing. So to the extent that they would be reviewing them, I think that's probably a good public policy. So I think that you're going the right direction with the A1 amendment. I don't have any problem with it.
Okay.
Further discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You can finish.
Further discussion on Senate File 276. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If I understand the amendment we just put on there, the department then will they, I'm sure I've asked this beforehand, but will the department now be able to say that the plan needs to have a certain level of reserves? Is that one of the design elements we're talking about?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, it's my intention, yes, because if you look up at on 313 through 15, and we've talked about, actually other people have mentioned these three lines, it's talking about the board has to include those features, the okay. stabilization reserves, reinsurance, claims reserves, working toward long-term stability and solvency. We're saying that I am saying here this language does plug in there that says the Department of Commerce must approve the elements under here. So those are the elements, okay. if you will. Right. But I believe that is something that the board will want to comply with. I mean, that they will want to be a stable plan, obviously. You know,
okay.
So, yes.
That's it. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 276. Senator Olson, you want to make a motion?
I move that the committee. I move that Senate File 276
as amended
be recommended to pass. I have to tell you, this is the first time I've ever done this.
You're doing good.
Thank
and
you.
And it needs to be re-referred
and be
to, state and
refers to state and local committee.
Perfect. On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
It passed.
The bill is passed and re-referred to the state and local government committee.
Thank you, members.
Thank you. Senator Scheid?
You're going to meet tomorrow on Senate file.
Members, thanks for the meeting this evening. We will meet tomorrow with Senator Berglund's.
Mr. Chairman, if I might say thank you to everybody for being troopers.
Thank you very much. Meeting's adjourned.